B-double-E-double-R-U-N, Beer Run. B-double-E-double-R-U-N, Beer Run. All we need is a 10 and a 5, or a car and a key and a sober driver. B-double-E-double-R-U-N, Beer Run.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I don't know when the beer run was invented, but the first beer was brewed some 5,000 years ago. That makes it more than a libation tradition, but an integral part of how humans developed. The popularity of beer in the United States has had its ups and downs, the prohibition being the biggest downer of them all. And for many years after its repeal, just a few beer brands were available to most Americans. That has changed. We are now in the craft beer era. And joining us by phone from Colorado to talk about the change and what it means is Julia Hertz. She's craft beer program director for the Brewers Association. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann.
We have craft beer, microbrews, and all these other distinctions. What are the differences between all of these titles for the uninitiated?
Sure. Well, within beer, the great beverage of beer, you have different size breweries, different classifications, brew pubs and microbreweries you bring up, generally based on the Brewers Association definition, make less than 15,000 barrels of beer a year. And the brew pubs are restaurant breweries. The microbreweries might have a tap room, but they're mostly packaging and sale to go. And then you have regional craft brewers who are distributing and selling regionally and sometimes even nationally. And then you also have the large global brewing companies.
What are the large globals?
The large globals are the big two that we all know, Anheuser-Busch, InBev, and MillerCoors.
Still. If you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the craft beer trend that has grown over the recent years in the United States and definitely in the state of Ohio and central Ohio. My guest right now, Julia Hertz, she's a home brewer and the craft beer program director for the Brewers Association. You're calling from Colorado, right?
Yeah, I am. It's cold here, and our cold is headed your way, I hear.
Yes, it is. But so far, it's like in the 60s, and I kind of wondered if there is good brewing weather.
Yeah, well, sipping on a winter warmer this time of year takes the edge off a little bit. Lots of good options out there on the local level. I mean, there's so many great beers. So, yeah, craft beer and weather go hand in hand.
In the 1970s, there were very few breweries in the United States, and they controlled, you know, more than 90% of the market and production. You mentioned the big two. How did those companies come to control the beer market so well?
Well, I think Prohibition, which, you know, we are at an important anniversary where Prohibition ended today in 1933, that was truly a low point, and it took a while for traction on the local brewery level from there. Fast-forwarding to 1978, another low point that just shows how long and how large of an impact that Prohibition had. We only had 42 brewing companies in 1978 even. And so from 1978 to today, you've got an evolution of 2,600 breweries, and that's where things have really opened up. Controlling interest from any one brewery is not what we want to see as beer lovers in this country. We want to see an opportunity for all breweries to thrive, whether they want to sell locally or nationally.
Before Prohibition, most breweries were small and what we think of as craft breweries now, weren't they?
Sure. And so, you know, we finally have reached the number of breweries in the United States that we had in the late 1800s, but we had even more in the mid 1800s, 3,000 plus breweries. So, you know, when Prohibition hit, it put a stop to everything. And then as breweries started to get, you know, cobble back together the pieces, you had a large German influence. And that's where you had, you know, German lagers, which turned into light American adjunct lagers, really carrying the day. And frankly, they're still 80% of the market today. But if you look at the last 10 years, where the craft brewing segment has 9% growth off a bigger and bigger base each year, the top 10 beer brands from the large breweries have basically lost share. And so, you know, we have a shift in taste of what's going on. It's a cultural shift in beer, because now that we have this diversity and selection on the local level, and the United States is literally the world's largest beer destination, which it wasn't in, say, the mid-50s when, you know, light American lager was carrying the day, you have a demand for more. And it's really kind of fascinating times to watch this all evolve.
It makes me wonder how much culture was lost, because we know in Columbus there was was the brewery district, and we see pictures and we've seen the photographs of the brewers shutting down, getting closed down, going out of business.
Dismal times, and I think the beverage of beer could have done better to attract our interest, our palates, our mindsets to want to, you know, gravitate more towards the beverage of beer. What's exciting to share is, I mean, beer, we are a beer-loving nation first and foremost today, no doubt about it. You basically have to take the sales of the wine in U.S. and spirits and combine them to match the $100 billion U.S. beer market. And so with that, you know, with being a beer-loving nation first and foremost, and now having flavor and diversity of literally 142 beer styles that we document at the Brewers Association, not just light American lager, but everything from ales and lagers and in between, you've got real exciting times for sure.
What triggered the new growth in the different styles of brewing? Was it the home brewers? I remember, you know, back in the 80s, people were starting to do green kinds of beer in their basement and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and, you know, that is one point. I mean, recently we've also had a challenged economy, so it's a legitimate question of, like, starting in the 70s when we were at that low point for the number of breweries, and then even thinking back several years ago when our economy shifted, you know, what has carried the day to help, you know, beer continue to thrive? And mm-hmm. I always answer it with many things have come into play all at once. The home brewing component is key. I mean, home brewers are very tied to their local breweries. And, you know, the beverage of beer, just like baking, just like canning, just like so many hobbies that are foodie-based, is done at home, and then that creates a more informed, you know, appreciator. And so that was one thing when Jimmy Carter signed into law. He put things in motion in 1978 to make it legal to homebrew up to 200 U.S. gallons per family household. And that was great. And then things started to boom from there. We host the Great American Beer Festival, which is a 30-plus year event now that started in 1982. And that started to catapult, I think, the competition for quality and the coveted you know, ways that brewers now in the U.S. are hanging their hat on making old-world beer styles as well as new-world beer styles with a twist. So competition, quality, access to those, the ability to brew at home, and, you know, an evolving foodie market, also the locavore movement, too, really has started getting people to think local beer and more diversity.
You talk about the old styles and the new styles. What's the new style like?
Well, of the 442 beer styles that I mentioned we document, you've got your classic old world styles. To answer the question in reverse of, you know, Bohemian Pilsners and Munich Helles and Munich Dunkel and, you know, German-based beer styles or Belgian-based beer styles like Belgian Pale Ales and Lambics and the styles that we've all heard about from great brewing nations. Then you throw in England, you've got Old Ales and ESBs, which are extra special bitters, or English IPAs. All those styles were basis for what our U.S. brewers, our U.S. craft brewers especially, are just going crazy with and really being artistic with. So from an English India Pale Ale English influence, we now have in the U.S. American IPA, which is more hop forward, more bitter forward, and then even Imperial IPA, which is kind of like a double IPA, more alcohol, but yet not at, you know, not 12% level like most wines are, mm-hmm. and then lots of flavor, lots of malt. So U.S. brewers just looked at the old world, said these are the base styles that we need to master, and then they started, you know, really experimenting with brewing process and ingredients to kind of create multitudes of things.
During the mid-90s and mid-2000s, there was a huge increase in the number of breweries opening in the United States. Were there any particular factors that led to those beer booms? Because, you know, like you said, Jimmy Carter signed the bill back in the 70s for home brewers that gave them that new lease on life. But what about the breweries that opened up?
Right. And, you know, to create change in anything in our culture, you need hits from all sides, influence from all sides. And so it really was a slow, uphill, 30-night success story that leads us to today's craft beer revolution in beer. And it's a great question, you know, how did breweries start to survive from the late 70s until today? And some of them didn't. One of the main breweries pegged to the start of this craft beer and microbrewing revolution is New Albion Brewing Company, which was out of California. And they survived 6 years. Jack McAuliffe is still around, but he did not survive as a brewery, although he influenced many others. So I think what started to happen is you had breweries get traction and enough momentum and literally starting to reach a tipping point of influence where small business brewers started to say, I think I can do this. I think I can convince my bank to lend me money. I think I can convince that landlord to give me, you know, that space. Mm-hmm. And it took a while for sure.
And what kind of backlash has there been from big beer as the small batch market grows? I would imagine, with distilleries, there's been a lot of buyouts and so forth. It's hard to find actually a really truly independent one in the country, although there is one in Columbus. What about the do you expect the big beers to buy up these smaller companies and, you know, still market them as the craft beers that they are, but take control?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, sure, great question. And, you know, big beers having to get used to small and independent brewers, and you bring up independence. Of the 2,600 breweries in the United States today, 98% of those 2,600 are small and independent craft brewers.
Okay.
We truly only have 50-some-odd breweries that are not craft brewers. And the large global corporate brewing companies are literally taking a look at the small mom-and-pop breweries and starting to morph and evolve their models, which is an incredible testament to, number one, a big small business success story, and number two, you know, a great part of our system is that, you know, small businesses can still thrive amidst the large, and the large have every right to survive and be supported and, mm-hmm. and need and you know, merit that, but at the same time, they're having to change their game to stay competitive because their major offerings of mostly one different beer style in many different packages, the light American lager, doesn't satisfy every beer lover's beer occasion every time now. So now they're seeing that beer lovers want porters, and they want different types of porters, and they want stouts, and they want ales, and they want, you know, American pilsners and the like. So they're changing their game. They are definitely making different moves business-wise to set in long-term motion that they will also and do also have domestic specialty brands that are more full-flavored.
Are there geographic trend lines among those 2,600 breweries in the United States? Do certain trends appear in certain parts of the country more fully than others?
I love that question, Anne. And I mean, the general answer is that the majority of Americans do live within 10 miles of a brewery. This is literally an every state movement with destinations in every state for groupings of breweries, which is super cool. But you have different areas of the country becoming known as destinations for different things. San Diego comes up a lot as just, you know, rebel West Coast brewers that are making very hop-centric forward beers. And, you know, brewery tourism is a major draw and boon to the area. I could go down the list from there on, you know, Chicago and where I'm at, Denver. New York is starting to really play up its history and have, you know, state organized even brewing trails. So there's lots of different areas. And then ingredient specific is starting to become a factor. You know, compared to the beverage of wine, which you're really only fermenting one ingredient, grapes, albeit many different varietals, mm-hmm. with beer on the scene, you're not just limited to malted barley. You can ferment other types of things that are sugar sources. And then you also, on top of that, have creative ingredients. Like if you're talking the South, you've got pecans and sweet potatoes. And, you know, different areas of the country are featuring their local hops that are able to thrive and grow. So ingredient-based beers are definitely becoming on the scene because of different regions.
Well, Julia Hertz, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun talking to you.
Many good beers to you, Anne, when you try them.
Thanks, Julia. Julia is a home brewer and the craft beer program director for the Brewers Association in Denver, Colorado. Coming up, we'll hear from a reporter for the Akron Beacon Journal who writes a beer blog, Rick Armin. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
With Jim Beam and Johnny Walker Red, woke up with a freight train running through my head. I'm a beer man. Bobby's more the wine kind, Johnny does his shots, Sammy sips martinis, Willie smokes pot, but I'm a beer man.
Okay, Okay. The popularity of craft beer has swept the nation. More than 60 breweries operate in Ohio alone. And the Buckeye State is winning accolades for its brews, with several medals won at the recent Great American Beer Festival in Denver. Home brewer and newspaper reporter Rick Arman has taken his hobby to the office, writing the beer blog for the online version of the Akron Beacon Journal, Ohio.com. He's also written a book about the topic, Ohio Breweries. Rick Arman, welcome to the show. Hello, Rick. Oops. Rick is on the air now. Hi, Rick.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Sorry about that.
Oh, that's okay.
Last time we checked, there were 61 breweries in Ohio. How many of these have launched in the past, say, decade? Can you give us some kind of timeline?
I was going to ask, the 61, when was the last you checked? That was a long time ago.
Oh, really? Okay, that's what my researcher gave me.
It was really interesting when I wrote the book and traveled around Ohio in 2010, there were 48. And we're pushing probably closer to 100.
Wow.
At this point, there's just been a real explosion in Ohio.
So from 2010 to now, that's 3 years, almost a 50% increase. I mean,
right.
Almost 100% increase, I should
right.
say.
Right, we've basically doubled here, and it's been really driven by new operations opening in Columbus, in Dayton, and Cincinnati, where there were either just a few breweries at that point, or in the case of Dayton, there were zero. So.
Huh. Ohio Beers recently won 8 medals at the Great American Beer Festival, the most since 1999. Is that a large number of medals to win? Having never been there, I don't know. Is this one of those places where everybody gets a prize, or is that pretty good?
No, it's very difficult to win a medal there just because of the sheer volume. The number of breweries that submit and the competition has gotten so much greater than the earlier years at the event. So it's difficult. I mean, it's a great feather in the brewery's cap for winning any medal out there, because quite honestly, if you're a brewery and you're submitting your beer to be judged there on a national basis, you have to believe that your beer is one of the best in the nation. So if you're winning a medal, you're the cream of the crop.
Now, are there regional competitions, that kind of vault you there, or can anybody try?
No, anyone, any brewery can submit. And a good example this year was Yellow Springs Brewery out of Yellow Springs. Just opened up, first time submitting a beer. The only beer they submitted, they won a medal for. And that's quite an achievement.
Of course, I guess it's a matter of taste, of course, but what exactly are these beers judged on?
Well, I mean, each beer is judged in a certain style category, and I mean, you're judged on the aroma, you're judged on, the taste and how it meets the style. So if you're sitting down and having a stout, you're judging it in a different way than if you're sitting down and having American Pilsner like a Budweiser or a Miller. Those beers don't compete in the same categories.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Rick Arman. He's a home brewer and a reporter with the Akron Beacon Journal and author of Ohio Breweries. It's a book about the topic, but he also writes a blog about beer for the Akron Beacon Journal. So we'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org. Tell us about your blog and what spurred that.
Well, I mean, I wanted an outlet for helping to promote the book when that came out, and decided to try to keep track of kind of Ohio news. I mean, I really don't do reviews of specific beers. I try to keep track of what brewery's doing what new beer is being introduced, what brewery is launching and opening, what brewery is closing, if there are any, are they upgrading their equipment. So I focus on beer news as opposed to reviews. And it's kept me very busy.
Apparently.
At the very beginning, it was funny when I launched it. I had this goal of interviewing every brewer and new owner that launched. And as I mentioned earlier, I mean, we've, you know, added, you know, nearly 50 breweries, and I quickly found out that was impossible to do and keep my regular job here at the paper as well.
Right. Did they poo-poo you when you first said you wanted to do this and think, yeah, you know, you're not going to have enough copy?
No, you know what? They didn't. However, I thought that. I didn't think there would be enough news. And I think the last I checked, I had written over 600 items this year for the blog. So there is there's a lot going on in the Ohio beer industry.
Julia Hertz told me there's 2,600 breweries today, operating today, 100 of them in Ohio. So Ohio's holding up its end of the stick, I guess, although it's a very populous state. It's not surprising that
right.
there's that many, I suppose, compared to the rest of the nation. But how does Ohio stack up?
You mean in terms of sheer numbers?
Numbers
or
and
quality
and just its reputation.
I think the reputation is growing here thanks to places like, you know, Hop and Frog and Jackie O's and Great Lakes are, you know, considered world-class brewers and consistently ranked in the top 100 in the world on ratebeer.com. And then you have places like, you know, Columbus, and the beer geek community goes nuts over its, but you know, their Bodie, which is a you know, India Pale Ale. So I think the reputation is growing outside of Ohio, and I think that other states, other brewers in other states, are realizing that as well. That this is a fantastic market for craft beer, because now they're starting to come into Ohio and distribute. Like, I don't know if anyone mentioned New Belgium and Deschutes, two of the, you know, top craft brewers in the nation in terms of volume, are going to be launching here in Ohio. New Belgium coming up, I believe it's next week or the week, maybe 2 weeks from now, and Deschutes in January.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with beer blogger Rick Arman. If you have a question or comment for him, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What is the tipping point for a brewery to decide to expand in that way to a state of like Ohio? What does it take?
Well, I mean, it takes their ability to produce a lot of beer because, I mean, as you mentioned, we're a very populous state. We have a lot of beer drinkers here. And part of the issue has been in the past that some of these craft brewers didn't want to move into Ohio because they didn't make enough beer to keep sending.
I don't know how to feel about
state.
That.
And that's why you've seen some of the large brewers out west have opened up breweries in, you know, say North Carolina, and part of the reason is to, you know, feed the eager beer drinking public that wants their beer, but their current facilities, they just can't keep up with demand.
Is there a quality issue too? Is there a difference with these smaller breweries and how they maintain their quality versus, say, you know, the biggies, you know, the Bud Light can be sitting out in my garage for 6 months. I think it'll taste about the same as it does.
You shouldn't store it in your garage.
Yeah.
But,
during the winter.
I don't think there's a major difference. I mean, the small folks put as much emphasis on quality as the large macro brewers. You know, as much as some beer geeks make fun of or just look down upon, you know, the Budweisers and the Millers and the Coors, it's very difficult to make that beer, and they do a fantastic job of it. I mean, they make that beer consistent every single time, and it's a light, you know, Pilsner, which it hides no flaws, and that's more difficult than, you know, to make than some people may realize.
Dan in Grove City, you're on the air with Rick Arman. Welcome, Dan.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Well, I wanted to see if any local breweries offer bock beer around here.
Bock beer. You know, I'm not sure that anybody does do a Bock. There probably are, and I just can't think of one. But you know, that would be coming out, you know, in the spring or in a couple months here. But
I've always liked Bock beers. It seems like it's got a good strong sweet taste to it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, coming up, we have Jim Ellison from Columbus Brew Adventures, and maybe he can tell us what they do if there's something like that on the tour. But thanks for that call. We'll check on that in a few minutes. Tell me about the seasonal approach to beer. Bud Light, as you mentioned, they have a consistency issue. They've got to be the same thing year round.
Right.
But one of the great things about craft beers is that they change. I mean, there's different opportunities for different flavors over the course of a season.
Right. Different brands, different styles. And the craft beer industry has done a great job of kind of almost having a beer for every season. I mean, you've got your Oktoberfest, your pumpkins, your Christmases, your Box, your, you know, summer fruit beers. They've really, you know, grabbed this niche. And part of the reason is the fact that, I mean, craft beer drinkers aren't necessarily loyal beer drinkers. I mean, while my grandfather may have, you know, always had a Busch, I don't go back to the same beer. I mean, I'm always trying something new, something different. And I think that, you know, the craft industry has done a great job of seizing onto that and providing kind of different styles during different times of the year. So, and as, you know, would you necessarily want a Christmas beer in August when it's really hot and you just finished mowing the lawn?
No, it sounds a lot more like how people drink wine. You know, a Sauvignon Blanc in the summer is nice. In the winter, you know, it's a little maybe too, you know, maybe not for some people.
Sure.
So I see what you mean exactly. So you don't have a favorite beer, I guess.
You know, I really don't. I mean, I bounce around so much. I do try to stay loyal to Ohio brands only because, I mean, the best beer is the freshest beer, and if I'm buying it, you know, from you know, someone here in Ohio, I know it hasn't been shipped across the country or sat in a warehouse for too long. So I tend to gravitate toward Ohio brands.
You said your goal was to interview every brewer that opened up, and you
right.
For obvious reasons, you know, that's almost impossible. But I was wondering, you haven't interviewed many brewers, right, in Ohio?
I've interviewed a ton, yes. and I mean, I'll be updating the book at some point. So I mean, I've physically visited almost every brewery in Ohio.
Do they have anything personality wise in common? Is there a certain personality that lends itself to, you know, that of a brewmaster?
Well, I mean, I think you have to be creative, and you have to be an artist to a certain degree, because if you're really putting something together to, you know, have a craft beer drinker go for your brand as opposed to, you know, the thousands of other brands available now, or the hundreds others that are at the grocery store, you really have to put your best foot forward. And a lot of these guys are creative. I've found that a lot of them have come from a science background because chemistry is so important to brewing. And the other big influence, I think, is mechanical, because some of these guys are creating their own brew houses and building their own brew houses. So those two seem to go hand in hand and are a little bit more prevalent. But then I meet phenomenal brewmasters like Matt Cole at Fatheads up in the Cleveland area, who has a degree in criminal justice. So, I mean, you know, sometimes it's just out of left field. But a lot of them tend to have that science background and also a mechanical background.
What about the labels? How much do they matter? And you know, now that we are seeing these huge arrays of craft beers at the grocery store, you know, your local Kroger, what does the label matter more than ever? And is that a big deal?
I think it's a big deal. If I walk into a store and I'm looking down the beer aisle and looking for something that I haven't tried before, or if I see a label, a brand that I haven't had, I'll stop and look at it. I'm trying to think, have I bought a beer based on a label? I probably have.
Uh-huh.
I mean, over the years. I can't think of one off the top of my head, but uh-huh. I did a story several years ago about how important tap handles are. Because if you walk into a bar and, you know, there's now some bars have like 80 tap handles, and you're looking, you've got to have a tap handle that stands out, something that, that's recognizable, that someone can come in and say, oh, there's my brand that I like among, you know, the so many that are there. Or they're, oh, wow, that's an interesting tap handle. What's that? So I'm sure labels do the same thing.
Well, Rick Armin, I want to thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Oh, sure. Thank you.
Rick Armin, he's a home brewer and a reporter for the Akron Beacon Journal and a blogger on the Akron Beacon's Journal's online the online Akron Beacon Journal. We'll have a link to that on our website at wosu.org/allsides. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Heaven, there is no beer. That's why we drink it here. And when we are gone from here, all our friends will be drinking all our beer.
Oh, yes. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I had a lot of fun picking out the music for this show today. Columbus is one of probably three cities at the center of the craft beer boom in Ohio. 8 breweries have opened in the last year alone, bringing the total to 10, I guess. More like 12?
11.
11, okay. The popularity of craft brews has inspired the launch of a new tour as well, Columbus Brew Adventures. Still with us is Rick Armin. He writes the beer blog for the online version of the Akron Beacon Journal at ohio.com. And joining us now in the studio is Jim Ellison. He's co-founder of Columbus Brew Adventures. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me today. I'm listening to the show all the time, so it's nice to be on this end of the mic.
Great. Thanks for listening. So when did the craft beer scene really start to catch on in Columbus?
Well, I say there's kind of been two eras for craft beer in Columbus. The first was the late 80s, early 90s, when the brewery district was starting to become a brewery district again. Mm-hmm. That was when Columbus Brewing Company started in 88. Hoster's started in 89. Barley's started in the short north in 1992. So that was kind of the first era. We had a good run of that. The brewery district kind of lost a little bit of its allure, I suppose, and kind of still great today, but just wasn't quite the hotbed that it was. I'd say really in the last 2 years is when the craft brewing industry in Columbus has really exploded. We've grown to 11 breweries right now, 2 more in development that I'm aware of. There's probably a couple that I haven't heard of. And it's a great, great, great community here. We've got lots of great people that support it. Three in particular that I would mention and single out would be Angelo Signorino at Barley's. He is the longest continuous brewer.
On High Street
brewer,
in the short north.
Yeah, in Columbus and Ohio. So 21 years of brewing experience. Lenny Collada, who helped found Barley's and operates Barley's Smokehouse and Brew Pub in Grandview. And Mary Martineau, who was formerly with the North Market, but now she's the executive director of the Ohio Craft Brewers Association. And she started the North Market Microbrew Festival, which has been really significant in growing that community in Columbus and Ohio.
Rick Armin, I was corrected last hour. There are 100.
Well, we're fast approaching 100 at this point in Ohio.
And Jim Ellison just told us that it's just been in the last couple years in Columbus there's been this explosion. Is that pretty much the way it's been across the state?
Yeah, it has. I mean, there was the whole craft beer universe here in Ohio was really centered around Cleveland and Akron, several years ago. And now, again, you've got this explosion going on in Columbus and Dayton and in Cincinnati as well. So, and then you've got little towns that are starting breweries like Flat Rock and Holgate and, Old Mill and Bidwell, out of the way places.
Because they can, because that's what it's all about, right? Jim Ellison, that's what makes what you do so much fun and so important to what you
do. That's what gave us the critical mass to be able to do tours. We just don't do one brewery tour here in Columbus. We have enough depth that we can actually do 6 or 7 different tours right now. We have a couple in development. So we have one that features a downtown brewery. So we do Columbus Brewing Company Restaurant, Barley's, Seventh Son, Wolf's Ridge, and North High Brewing. We kind of jokingly refer to the Grandview Brewery District, which is where a lot of the growth is right now. Sideswipe just went into production. Pigskin and Land Grant are in development out there. And for our tour, we do Barley's Smokehouse, Zauber, Four String Brewing, and then we wrap it at Ohio Tap Room, which has probably one of the most unique growler fill systems you've seen anywhere.
Rick Harmon, have you ever written about where they come up with the names?
People are always trying to come up with unusual names. Sometimes it's, Columbus Brewing. I mean, it's kind of boring. It's Columbus. And there's places like Granville Brewing. And I always ask the question, where'd you come up with your name? And I mean, sometimes it's because people wanted to just identify with a community. Or sometimes it just happens to be some name that they enjoyed. There's a great name up here in Worcester that it's called JAFB Worcester Brewery. And the owner and his brother, and they were sitting around just trying to come up with, what should we call our place? And his brother said at one point, it's just another fill-in-the-blank brewery. And guess what their name is? JAFB Brewery. It's difficult nowadays to come up with a name, too, because, as you mentioned, I mean, with 2,600 nationwide, you've got to try to come up with a unique name. I mean, there's names here in Ohio like Trailhead that opened in the Akron area. And guess what? There are a couple other Trailheads, throughout the U.S., and there's Rivertown Brewing in Cincinnati, and there's a Rivertown Brewing in Pennsylvania.
Because there's a river
in Pittsburgh. Yeah. Although they have an E at the end of theirs.
Oh, okay.
But still, it's getting more difficult to come up with a name.
Yeah, yeah. Jim Ellison, how do you put together your tours? Is there a theme? Because there's so much to choose from now.
We really, on each tour, we try to make it a very just fun experience. It's a mix of, obviously, there's beer, but there's education too. And we try to craft it so that at each spot, you're getting a little different piece of the brewing pie, right? So at every brewery, you don't want to go, hey, here's the brewing process again and again and again. So for example, at Columbus Brewing Company Restaurant, we'll talk about the history of CBC, the history of the brewing district, a little bit of beer history, and walk through the three beers there. Then we'll head to Barley's. We'll talk about the history of Barley's, but also Angelo gives us a history of kind of microbrewing Columbus in the form of four beers. So, they start with McLennie's Scottish Ale, which was the first beer that they brewed. So he'll go through the process, what inspired that, where the name came from.
Do you take them to the basement, too?
When we can. It depends on how crowded Barley's is. Barley's Underground is a wonderful spot. Actually, I'm going to be using that as part of my wedding coming up next year. So I love that spot. And we're in there probably about half the time. Then our next stop is Seventh Son Brewing, where Colin Vent, who's a great story behind how he got into brewing, walks us through the ingredients. So we'll taste barley, malt, hops, go through all the ingredients and different types of ingredients, too. There's not just one type of malt, one type of barley. And after people kind of get that education, then we go in to taste the beers, and Colin will kind of pull out, okay, for this stout, these are the ingredients that we talked about that are in here. This is where you can taste it. And then typically we'll wrap up at North High Brewing, and Gavin there will walk through their assisted brewing process where people can go in, brew their own beer, come back in a couple weeks and bottle it, learn about the beer process that way. But his brewery has this incredible history to it, both the building itself and all the repurposed items that they brought in from some actually OSU buildings that are no longer around. So each tour is you're getting a wide range of stuff. And at the end, whether you are a beer geek, or even if you don't like beer, we've had some non-beer drinkers on the tour that I've been happy to say not only decided that they found at least one beer that they liked, but really had a better appreciation for it. We even had one gentleman that didn't drink at all. He just wanted to come along to learn, and he felt that he had just got a lot of beer knowledge and had a lot of fun in the process.
These aren't beer pub crawls.
Right.
These are beer tours. They're different. There's a distinction.
Yeah. I mean, we do have a good amount of beer sampling on the tours. We're typically doing 3 to 4 samples at each spot. So it's a good amount of beer. It's spread out over 3.5 hours. We do start off with food. We want to help that be part of the process.
Okay.
At Wolf's Ridge, we even add in a beer and food pairing where we teach people how to pair certain types of foods with certain types of beer. So, you know, that is part of that education process, too. A lot of times we think just wine and food are something to consider how they go together. But beer and food really is something that you need to consider as well.
An email from a listener writes, I'm a cheapskate and always afraid to try new beers because I'm afraid I might hate it and waste my money. Are there scheduled taste testings around town? And of course there are. That's why we're talking to Jim Ellison of the Columbus Brew Adventures. We'll have a link to their website at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. But what about that idea of afraid I might hate it and waste my money? A lot of places, well, you only have to buy one. Can you get, will breweries give you taste before you buy a growler or something like that?
Yeah, many places where you go, you can get a small flight of beers and do a selection of different beers to help find what you want. And that's the general format of what we do on our tours. We're giving you a selection of different beers to kind of find and educate yourself. Ohio law, you can't give away a free sample to someone. You have to charge for it. But you can go to a place like Ohio Tap Room where you can get a sample of beer for 50 cents and sample for several different ones. When you find that one that you like, or those two or those three, then you can fill it up with a growler and go home and enjoy it and come back. The next time you come back, they're going to have a different variety of beers to try from and keep educating yourself over and over again.
Boy, Rick?
I was going to say, I feel that person's pain, too, because I'm kind of a cheapskate. And I mean, you go in, if the person's going to the grocery store and checking out, you know, $9.99, $10.99, $11.99, a six-pack, I've ended up investing, you know, in a beer and then just didn't enjoy it, not because it was bad. It was just not my style. But I would recommend, you know, going to, as Jim mentioned, going to the places and just asking for a sample. And one of the best ways to find out what you do like is go to a festival. Hmm. Go to a beer festival where, you know, you pay one amount to get in, and then you can wander around and sample, you know, different beers. And if you don't like it, pour it out and move on to the next thing. And that festivals are a great opportunity to just try a million different things and find out what you do like and what you don't like.
And in the grocery stores, more and more, they're letting you put your own six pack together too.
Right. So you can, you know, buy a single bottle, and that cuts down on, you know, buying a six pack and realizing you have 5 beers you don't want to drink.
So, Jim Ellison, how do your tours change over time? Is it a constantly changing process because there's always something new to explore?
There's elements that are the same. There is a learning curve, and there's things that we tweak over the course of time. It can also depend on which person we're featuring on the tour. When Angelo, who's one of the brewers at Barley's, guides us through a tasting, it's different than when, say, Kyle or somebody else does.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on which brewery we go to, we'll have a slightly different experience there. And we're constantly adding tours, too, based on what people are interested in. So we have a pizza and beer tour that's actually starting this month that's pairing 4 iconic pizzerias with 4 local or regional beers. We'll be adding a walking tour of the brewery district in the spring. So we'll be covering the history of the area, which has incredible depth. And also, obviously, adding some beer and maybe some wine and food as part of that, too. So we are constantly growing what we have to offer to folks to help really grow and support the craft industry here in Columbus.
An email from Fred asks what Rick's take is on all the science and lab stuff happening in these breweries. Will it affect the economy and actually make more science and high-tech jobs?
I don't know about that. I mean, in general, you know, some of the science labs that are only at the larger breweries and a lot of the smaller nano operations, they don't have their own science labs or employ, you know, techs to be checking things. They just kind of do it on their own. I don't see an explosion in
a high-tech brewing industry
right.
explosion.
Right.
And I will jump in real quick as far as that high-tech. Rick, have you been to actual brewing here in Columbus?
Yes.
Yeah.
And they do have a great lab there, and they do I'm sorry, I'll let you go. You were probably going to explain.
Oh, no problem. Fred Lee there is a great character, very passionate about
beer.
Well,
this might be email from Fred because he says,
okay.
P.S., we love you and Rick Armin. Come out to the brewery tonight and I'll buy you guys a pint. So it might be the same guy.
Yeah. Actual Brewing, in addition to making really good beer, they're also one of the few yeast labs in this part of the country. So they create yeast for other brewers.
Okay.
And Fred is very much a evangelist for water. Now, Columbus has good water. That's why we have a lot of breweries based here. But he actually works on his system that he can create a specific type of water because he always wants to have the exact same water in his brewing process. So if somebody's interested in the art and science, there are elements of that there. And, you know, the brewing, to be a true brewmaster, you know, if you have training at UC Davis or someplace like that, it's a lot of education. It's not just the fun of making beer. There's a lot of science that goes to it to keep that yeast going and to really create unique beers.
Comment from Christopher. He writes, Cincinnati brews a number of different Bock beers. Most are introduced at the local Bock Fest Beer Festival in late winter, early spring. This is a great festival, including a parade and the tapping of the first wooden keg of Bock beer for the season, which Jim Ellison might want to address the question from earlier
Bock beer. I can't think of a Bock beer that's currently out in Columbus. I'm sure that there's one somewhere, or there has been, or there will be. A great place to read about that would be the Drink Up Columbus blog, which has reviews of just about every beer here in Columbus. For that style of beer, the listener would probably have a good chance of finding something in that spectrum at Zauber Brewing, which is very close in some of their beers to a Bock style. North High Brewing has a lot of beers that would kind of fall near that spectrum, too.
What's a Bock style?
I'll defer to Rick on that since he's written much more about that than I have.
Rick Armin?
You know what? I don't know why my mind's blanking right now. It might be the head cold.
It must be.
Generally, it was a style that was brewed in the spring, and It was a little heavier and a little bit more higher in alcohol than the typical like lager. I don't know why I'm blanking right now on the specifics related to Bock.
That's okay. It happens to me all the time.
We'll make sure to throw that in as part of our next tour and specifically talk about Bock in depth.
Inspired by.
Right.
Yeah. It's quite honest. It's not a style that you hear much about anymore today. And I forgot about how, there is the big Bock festival down in Cincinnati. And with their German heritage down there, they really play up the Bock.
There are brewery tour operations like Columbus Brew Adventures all over the place now, right, Rick? Right, Rick?
Yeah. It's interesting because, here you've had the craft industry kind of explode, and then you've had, folks who are noticing that and spawning their own little industries. You know, there's the beer shuttles and bus tours up here in Cleveland, down in Cincinnati as well. And in any major city now, you're bound to find brew bus.
Jim Ellison, co-owner of Columbus Brew Adventures, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. Also, Rick Armin of Ohio Brewery, author of Ohio Breweries, thanks to you as well. Thanks to All Sides intern Andrew Zissler for producing this show and the rest of the All Sides staff. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.